Blog Talk Radio.
Post-apocalyptic radio show here on Blog Talk Radio, where we talk about everything about the post-apocalyptic genre. This episode today, we're going to talk about The Colony, Discovery Channel's The Colony, which premiered last Tuesday on the 21st. And it was a pretty interesting premiere here for something a little different. Obviously, there are other shows like Survivor, Survivors, and other survivalist type shows out there, but this is the first one that really delves into, say, the aftermath of a post-apocalyptic, you know, survival mode, or after some type of catastrophe. The premise behind on this The Colony here on Discovery Channel is we basically have 10 survivors who basically have survived through a virus epidemic, pandemic, that has wiped out or decimated most of the population. And what's left are basically a few wandering survivors and marauders that are running around, and everybody's vying probably for resources, food, supplies, And this starts off as the show last Tuesday is basically the let me first of all introduce the 10 we have here and their expertise. We have Allison White, a nurse; Amy West, a marine scientist; George Falaris, a doctor; Joey Saskaya, the independent contractor, and I may be not pronouncing his last name correctly. Not even going to try it again. But I would just call him Joey. Joey is the independent contractor. John Cones, computer engineer; John Valencia, machinist; Liliana Smith, the martial arts instructor; Michael Raines, solar technology tech; Morgan Hooker, an aerospace engineer; and Vladimir Beck is the mechanical engineer. So those are our 10 survivors that we're focusing on here in this post-apocalyptic reality show. Now, each one has a particular expertise, which I think some people are kind of debating on some of the in the forum there at The Colony. How would such expertise postgraduate group actually, is it realistic for such a highly educated group to fall together? You could debate that one way or other. Obviously, you know, in a urban environment such as L.A., obviously there's going to be probably more highly educated people around. Although I would have to agree, the chances of getting this highly educated bunch together so soon after an apocalypse, maybe not as realistic. I think you would think it probably would be more. The truck driver, or the more lay people, or workers, involved in a group that, obviously that is just coming together with different backgrounds. But that, I regress. It's makes the show even a little bit more interesting because of the high nature of them putting together their expertise in order to come up with to make a lot of these survival tools and other equipment that they're going to use and methods to survive through this initial in urban post-apocalyptic scenario. Now, the first thing I was interested about, let me first of all just go into what the first episode. Basically, six of the survivors are, you know, banded together, and they find what they call a sanctuary. Sanctuary is this humongous, huge warehouse there, and I don't have the actual square footage, but I believe it's enormous. I think we're talking about, something over 3,000, I think it's even a lot more than that. It's just huge. I have to get that later, the actual square footage, and talk about that as far as, you know, the sanctuary itself. I do know that this warehouse is on about a 3.5 acre lot, so it's a pretty big area. And apparently the six fires find this old abandoned warehouse and basically, you know, set up shop there. Then they find some of tools laying around. They do, before that, though, do find a department store or a food house or some type of department store, and they're able to forage and scavenge some food and other goods before they enter into the sanctuary. And later on, the next day, the four remaining survivors come out of the city there. I wanted to say coming out of the wasteland, but we're not necessarily sure exactly where, you know, everybody is coming. We're thinking that they're all come out of, or right out of the LA area, and there's, you know, it's just not very specific on exactly where everybody is from. Assuming, you know, this is LA, everybody has survived, just coming out of this LA area. Anyhow, four survivors, the remaining four survivors, show up at the door, and our six survivors that found the sanctuary let them in. So now we have 10. And out of those first moments, they kind of start planning as far as how to purify the water, which is a pretty good idea. And they found a water resource nearby, which is a canal there in L.A. And they basically also put batteries together in order to power up some lights. So they're already starting to work on certain survival aspects. I guess let me get more onto some of the little peeves, little things that I saw that I wasn't too sure that. That I thought they didn't cover too well on. Initially, you would think they would go into scavenging mode even on day one. Now, granted, I understand they have food stores there. They're saying for up to about 9 days now, even including the four remaining survivors that they let in. That's another thing that I don't understand. If four people show up at your warehouse and you only have food stores enough for your, you know, six people, you know, I would expect the four people that come in, you know, you bring some food in with you, you know, you show up, you know, offer something in order, why should I let you in? But they do let them in, so, and that lessens the amount of food that's available to ration that they currently have stored there in the sanctuary. And that's my one little peeve that I found that, that first episode, they go through about day one to day four. By day two, you know, you would think that you would already start sending out one or two people in opposite directions to go ahead and locate food stores. Also, not only just to locate food in where, you know, the homes, mom and pop stores, department stores, warehouses, then locate these food stores, but you think they would also be looking out there as far as reconnaissance, wanting to know where the marauding bands are at. Do they have a home base? Are they more central located in one spot? What is their routine? Do they travel throughout the city? You know, what is the danger spot? So, you know, this to me would be, you know, you want to know that right off the bat. And the main thing I would say about scavenging for food is you can have a castle, you can have forts. It doesn't matter, you know, the best living condition there is you can find, but if there's no food source nearby or sustain, you know, your shelter, it's useless. And so, you know, I would, you know, instead of, you know, obviously getting the war, that was very important, and I thought that was, you know, very, you know, good on their part on that first day or second day, you know, to locate the water canal and begin purifying the water. That's obviously very essential. But as I said, they don't even in the first episode really go into, even seems like there's not a priority to find food stores. And I just find that, you know, for survival aspect, you know, because I'll take it that this is an urban environment. It's probably given that that you would expect a lot of, you know, your homes, the stores, places are going to be food store. But if you have marauders, you have other bands running around, and there are probably other groups in a large, even a post-apocalyptic urban area, because you would think that people outside of the greater L.A. area that may have survived probably may be gravitating towards these large cities and urban areas because they know that there's food stores there. So, and there's only a finite, even though you think there's probably millions of food laying around, canned goods and such, obviously people are going to, you know, hoard these things, and they're going to start stocking them up, and that comes to, you know, a finite amount of goods, food to find even in a large city like L.A. So I think they're going to touch more on that on the second episode tonight. And it's at 10 o'clock tonight on the East Coast. And I would expect that we'll see more foraging or more priority on that. And I would have thought at least by the second day, somebody, and that's, you know, would have got up, you know, in a leadership role or something and said, look, you're going to have to go here. Especially the new people that came in. That Joey guy, I would have already had him and one other person, maybe Mike Haynes or Mike Raines, I believe his name is, and had them, you know, already, you know, scouring around at least a radius, a couple of mile radius or so around the sanctuary to find out what is there and what's not there, what's available, and what's going to help them survive. And obviously food is very essential in a situation like this. Another little thing that I didn't quite get, and I saw it somewhere on the forums here today as I was reading it, is weapons, guns. I find it very improbable that, that in after a post-apocalypse, believe me, people are going to be packing. And with all the gun stores, pawn shops, the homes, all the weapons, almost a third of all Americans are gun owners. So, you know, there's going to, you know, it just doesn't, I didn't understand that aspect. Not any of the survivors had any weapons on them or guns. It's just a fact that's going to be part of any survival equipment that you're going to need for, especially, you know, protection, and also order or weapons, you know, and guns. And, you know, I would argue that the beginning of the show, when the six survivors are walking, I would imagine in a real post, at least one person out of the six would be packing. You know, if you're going down in an urban environment like L.A., I'll give it that, yes, there may be, you know, because the population is so small, maybe they're not really running it except for the few marauders, and apparently, maybe just for this experiment, they're not dangerous, but obviously, I wouldn't take any chances in a situation like this where you know, the strongest survive, you know, and the weakest die, you know, and at least that's what the simple survival guide of the marauders may be. But anyhow, I just think you know, why they didn't even, I mean, they maybe didn't have to have real guns, but at least they would show having weapons or some weapons, that would make it more realistic to me. And another interesting thing I wasn't sure about, because this is a viral scenario, and you would obviously concluded there would be millions, especially in L.A., or 15 million rotting corpses in a city such as the size of L.A. Obviously, you know, decomposing, and if this is the midsummer, the amount of the smell, and also the animal infestation part, the rats, the explosion, some of that I haven't seen really touched on. And, dilutes some of the real reality of a post-apocalyptic scenario. And, you know, as I said, if this is a disease or a viral scenario, there's obviously going to be, again, millions of decomposing bodies. And that's going to cause a massive animal infestation. Again, you know, we think about rats. I mean, just not only just from the corpses, but also from all the food, the grains, everything laying around. The rat explosion will probably be almost unbearable. So, and this is what's unique, I mean, interesting about an urban post-apocalyptic scenario. Some would wonder, you know, would you even stay in the city? I mean, other than there being food stores in an urban environment, and lots of them, which is very essential, being very close proximity to the city and all of the, as I said, of the decomposing of the bodies, and if people, you know, that can relate to other diseases, can be very dangerous. And so that was just something I was wondering about as I watched here on the first episode. Now, one thing I thought was interesting also is when the four remaining survivors that show up the next day, when Joey, one of the four, you know, he enters into the sanctuary. Now, remember, the six survivors that are already in there are being very protective, or very, you know, have to be very guarded, obviously, because of the danger, you know, of any stranger, somebody showing up. Now, if that's the case, automatically, when Joey starts asking him questions about their food stores, their water, and this and that, one, I would never let him ask a question. You know, you don't, you're not here, you're not right now capable of asking questions, only, you know, answering answers at this point. And the lady who answered him and started telling him about how much food they, that's information you would never want to tell a stranger, somebody right off the street. You know that you're opening yourself up to be looted, or a Trojan horse, possible. But anyhow, my point is that part I just thought was kind of, it's, some of the survivors seem to be a little more open or not, realizing how, difficult surviving, in the dangers of the people around their environment, and when one of the original six survivors, I believe it's John, the machinist, starts rifling, going through some of their luggage to see if they don't have any weapons or other stuff, Joey gets angry. He says, don't stop me. Well, right there, he might have been already out of the sanctuary, gone. He's out of my experiment. But anyhow, because you have to be very careful, I would think, who you let in. And also, at this point, when you let these four people come in and they're not even bringing any food, they're obviously, more straight on your resources. And at this point, you haven't even established what they're bringing to the table. What can they do for your group to survive? And until that is established, at that initial point, my point is basically this. In this experiment, I think if they do start showing, you would think strangers coming to, yes, you may have sympathy for it's a terrible situation, but this is a very, very precarious situation that you're in, and it's life or death, pretty much. If you allow the wrong person into your sanctuary, and you could be letting somebody in that may be, disguising themselves as a, you know, could be a marauder disguising himself as a survivor. But that's just something I just thought was just kind of strange. Well, not strange, but I just thought that that if you would see in the survivors a little bit more guarded behavior. Okay, I guess that's probably the best way to describe it. I think tonight, though, on tonight's episode, they're going to go more into a little bit, as I said, on the foraging and scavenging, which probably should make it more realistic. And I want to, one other point real quick about letting in survivors. What if, you know, as I was just talking about Joey in that group that came in, what if it is a pregnant woman, 6 months pregnant, and three starving children, you know? These are decisions that, you know, you're going to run into. Now, do you allow, you know, four people, you know, a mother, a pregnant woman, and 3 year children, and, you know, obviously you need the sympathy value, you know, sympathies, you know, in your heart, but do you allow them, because that's four more people to feed. I mean, what is your food? And that's another thing, I go back to the food source problem. At this moment right now, except for what they, on the first episode, they scrounged from that department store, there is no food source. There's no food. We assume there is. I would assume that there has to be in a large environment like this, but there has to be that establishment of, you know where are we going to, you know, where are the stores at? Where are the food stores at? Where, you know, we have to, you know, locate these, and we need to, you know, bring them back into the sanctuary. We need to store this food and protect it. And by doing that, also then you can expand on other, you know, survival aspects and having some kind of semblance to some working society that that perhaps this group is looking to create. And those are some of that was the main thing. Overall, though, I thought it was great. I thought it was very interesting. It was, it's about as realistic, at least to some parts, as far as the survival aspect. And the people who are, you know, they're obviously keeping their mind, or at least, you know, to the realization, or at least acting, at least this is the reality. This is what we're at, you know, and this is what is on the outside. And you see some of that as far as their setting up guard, you know, at night, and then, you know, working to find the water and how to purify it, and also collecting water from the roof, which I thought was a very, you know, that was a pretty good idea to collect the rainwater. So, you know, all in all, I would have to say, you know, as far as a reality of post-apocalyptic show, you know, it's the closest thing that we've seen to anything like this. And, you know, obviously, you know, you can only get so close. I mean, the reality of a real post-apocalyptic environment is probably immeasurable as far as the emotions and the physical dangers in the adversity that you know, the survivors would be faced with. It just would, you know, but because of that, those thoughts and how bad it probably would be, that's why I, you know, put so much emphasis on the food. Why not any guns, you know? And those are, you know, and also the taking in new members or excluding, or waving off people, you know, away from the sanctuary. So, well, let's see. This is just the beginning of the first episode. There's many more to come. There's a lot of different survival equipment, that the things that they're going to put together, such as for solar tracking, and they're going to be probably doing some planning or grueling. And that's another quick thing I just wanted to touch on before we go here. This is an urban post-apocalyptic scenario, obviously, okay? And there's a difference from that in an agrarian or more rural type post-public scenario, which would probably make for a very interesting season two, because one would think, as I said before, because there's the dangers, excessively dangerous in an urban environment like they're in, and the finite amount of food stores that eventually, over time, you are going to eventually dwindle, you have to have more long-term strategy, and obviously that takes into account that you're going to have to either start livestock, growing your own food, and I'm not so sure L.A. is probably the best place that I would think about starting an agrarian type society, but we'll have to wait and see. Those are just little things that we're thinking about, and you know, obviously, if you're watching the show, maybe discussing with your friends or family or yourself as you watch this season, first season of The Colony. Well, that's going to do it here for this afternoon. I'll be back next Tuesday. I believe that'll be the 4th, August 4th, next Tuesday, 3:30 here on the East Coast, as I review again another episode of The Colony. That'll be obviously episode 2, and next Tuesday will be episode 3, and we'll take a look at episode 2 next week and discuss more about this post-apocalyptic reality show, and I hope you tune in next Tuesday. You have a great afternoon, and again, tonight at 10 o'clock, The Colony, Episode 2. Have a good day.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got the shock. When they landed on Plymouth Rock, if today any shock they should try to stand, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good offers to who once knew better words, now only used for letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if fair limbs you like, if May West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that smart is intruding at nudist parties in studio, anything goes. When a Mrs. Ned McLean, God bless her, can get Russian red to yes, then I suppose anything goes. When Rockefeller still can hoard enough money to let Matt Gordon produce his show, anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and that gent today, you gave a cent today, once had several chateaus. When folks who still can ride in jitneys find out Vanderbilts and Whitneys lack baby clothes, anything goes. When Sam Goldwyn can with great conviction instruct Anna Sten in diction, then Anna shows anything goes. When you hear that lady mental standing up, now does a handspring landing up on her toes, anything goes. Just think of those shocks you got, and those knocks you got, and those blues you got from those news you got, and those pains you got in any brain you got from those little radios. So Mrs. R, with all her trimmings, can broadcast the bed from Simmons, cause Frank will know anything goes.